Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now. Jeremy is out today. And numbers out last night show Donald Trump's fundraising efforts are falling far behind Hillary Clinton's by a lot. His campaign started June with $1.3 million in the bank. Clinton started the month with more than $40 million. The Super PAC numbers, which aren't technically connected to either candidate, weren't much better. The Super PAC supporting Clinton brought in $12 million, while the Super PAC behind Trump brought in just over $1 million. NPR political reporter Danielle Kurtzleben is tracking this. Hi, Danielle.
Hi.
What else can you tell us about these numbers?
Well, you've hit on the big number that everybody is really talking about, is this cash on hand number. I got to tell you, I've been going through these two campaign finance reports, and the discrepancies are so big, I've been double and triple checking myself to make sure I've got it right. Because, you know, so here are a couple other things in here that are kind of telling. Donald Trump spent around $6.7 million last month on everything, you know, from his campaign committee. Clinton spent around $14 million. So already you can tell she's, you know, spending more, you know, putting more money into, you know, doing the various things that campaigns do. One thing is payroll. Donald Trump, by one report in the Washington Post, spent around $680,000 on payroll last month. Clinton spent $2.4 million on payroll. By some reports out there, Trump has, you know, approaching 70 people, full-time people on his payroll. Clinton, by other reports, has nearly 700.
Well, this is also important because of advertisements on TV.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, because advertisements, they're not everything a campaign spends on, but they're a lot of what a campaign spends
on. And they matter.
Oh, they do. I mean, you know, and any number of people will tell you different things, that they only give you a temporary bump and that sort of thing. But the point is, you know, it's about, you know, telegraphing your latest achievements, your latest speeches, and, you know, the other guy's, you know, faults to the people.
Well, Trump did the morning show circuit today defending himself. Here he is on the Today Show.
It gets to a point, what I'll do is just do what I did in the primaries. I spent $55 million of my own money to win the primaries. 55. Now, you know, that's a lot of money. I mean, by even any standard. I may do that again in the general election.
You just said you're having...
Excuse me, Matt. I have a lot of cash, and I may do it again in the general election.
And Trump's supporters will say, look, he has bad fundraising numbers because he, as he just said, is spending his own money. And today he sent out an email that said he would match every dollar that comes in over the next 48 hours, up to $2 million. So people saying, well, maybe he doesn't need all of this money.
Right. And, you know, he has contributed to his campaign. The measure in this latest finance report was around $46 million, a bit over $46 million. So, you know, he's right. That is not nothing. However, it takes a lot more to finance a presidential campaign. Some numbers from 2012. Obama, and this is total, not at this point, but total. In 2012, his campaign committee alone spent $721 million. Mitt Romney spent around $450 million. Now, you add in party spending and outside group spending, you know, those super PACs that we talk about. It was more than $1 billion for each party and their associated groups. So you need a lot of money. And the thing is, we don't exactly know how much Donald Trump is worth. So, yes, he is a rich person, of course, by any standard. But is he rich enough to finance a presidential campaign? We're not sure.
Well, and he's also making the point today that it is insane that politicians are spending that money, much money, that it takes that much money to run a general election. But what can you say about Republicans in general? Because, you know, as we know, they're trying to keep control of the Senate this year. Does Trump's fundraising efforts trickle down ballot?
Well, to back up on that, I mean, yes, it takes a lot of money to run a campaign. And of course, Trump has gotten a lot of free media attention. We've seen those cable news shots where they'll stand on an empty podium just waiting for him to talk. But you have to spend on more than that. You have to spend on data, knowing what voters you're going after. You have to spend on fundraising. You have to spend money to make money. So that is also what you have to spend money on. Now, as far as the Republican versus Democratic parties, the parties, you're right, have to support the presidential candidate as well financially. So yes, if the Republican Party finds itself having to help prop up Donald Trump's campaign, yeah, they will have less money to spend on down ballot races. And the Democrats, conversely, because Hillary Clinton has been doing quite well with fundraising, will have more resources to spend on Democratic down ballot races.
Yeah. And is the party trying to make it up?
Well, both parties, of course, are going to be fundraising pretty aggressively. One interesting thing, though, that you can pull out of these reports that, you know, a couple coworkers and I were talking about today was, you know, listen, Donald Trump really is doing more poorly than Hillary Clinton on fundraising. And yet, Hillary Clinton, you know, he's still competitive with her. He's still polling above 40%. Yeah. So the question is, you know, at what point could slash does this hurt him?
NPR political reporter Danielle Kurtzleben, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Well, let's turn to immigration now. 2 years ago, gang violence and poverty in Central America drove tens of thousands of people to cross into Mexico with the hope of reaching the U.S. To stem that tide, the U.S. expanded its enforcement efforts by assisting Mexico at its southern border, and it worked. Last year, fewer migrants made it to the U.S. But human rights activists say there's also evidence of a rise in abuses. Lauren Madelon from the Fronteras desk at Here Now contributor KJZZ in Phoenix reports.
To set the scene, let's get on the river that separates Guatemala and Mexico, Rio Suchiate.
Mucho!
We're on a raft, one of dozens, that ferries people and goods back and forth 24-7.
Corn, beans, rice, oil, eggs.
That's Guatemalan Carlos Mejia. Deported, he says, from the U.S. last year. He wouldn't tell me why. Now he's part of a floating black market that also includes U.S.-bound migrants. Authorities on a legal border crossing, a bridge about 200 yards away, look down and do nothing. Mejia says there'd be riots if anyone actually tried to seal this river because people need the work.
Any of these days, police or the government try to come and close this, this is going to be a big trouble.
This border between Mexico and Guatemala remains porous even after the U.S. convinced Mexico to start Plan Frontera Sur, its southern border plan, in July 2014. Mexico sent at least 300 immigration agents to the south, raided trains and migrant hostels, and set up mobile checkpoints in the Mexican interior. 2 years later, at a small diner north of the border, a man from Nicaragua asks for money to continue his way north. His worry now? You're a trophy catch right now, he says. They're hunting us down, he says. Since 2014, Washington's committed at least $100 million to support Mexico's southern border program. As of February of this year, $20 million's been delivered. At least one Mexican immigration agent is grateful for the help. She'd only talk if we didn't identify her, fearing retribution from her superiors. The agent showed me her credentials, was in uniform, and arrived with a trusted go-between. I've seen U.S. Customs and Border Protection officers here, she said. She said CBP agents work regularly inside a migrant detention center near the border. Our border is weak, she said. U.S. agents interview migrants that we catch. They can identify people we've deported before, and that help has been crucial, she added. In the first 13 months of Plan Frontera Sur, deportations of Central Americans from Mexico rose by nearly 70%. Some critics say that number comes at the expense of human rights. Clara Long is with Human Rights Watch in San Francisco.
U.S. involvement in the southern border of Mexico is worrying precisely because of how hidden it is, not just in terms of what the U.S. is doing, but what Mexican authorities are doing with U.S. support.
Mexico and the U.S. don't speak openly about their work in southern Mexico. Responding to our request for information on U.S. participation on the Mexico-Guatemala border, U.S. Customs and Border Protection said, quote, "We support our Mexican customs and immigration counterparts with a variety of technical assistance and capacity-building programs aimed at both enhancing security and facilitating legitimate travel and trade." Adam Isaacson at the Washington Office on Latin America isn't surprised by the statement's vagueness.
There's sensitivity about anything that looks like the gringos coming down and telling them what to do.
Meanwhile, Mexico's Human Rights Commission says complaints of extortion and violence by immigration agents rose by 52% in year one of Plan Frontera Sur. In one case, agents are alleged to have beaten and robbed a Salvadoran migrant of the equivalent of $1,000, then deported him. In another case, agents are accused of collaborating with organized crime to extort migrants for the right to continue north.
I think it's a crime.
Human rights worker Diego Lorente is one of the few people not in law enforcement allowed into the detention center.
No, pues es que el plan Frontera Sur.
He believes U.S. pressure on Mexico complicates an already chaotic environment.
Está sufriendo ahora mucho más que hace dos, tres años.
The situation for migrants today, he says, is worse than in the last two or three years. If migrants do make it past the border into the interior of Mexico, they face numerous checkpoints manned by a stew of law enforcement agencies, immigration, police, the army. Yet thousands of migrants are undeterred. All across the southern border region, you see groups of them, in shelters, in buses, on the roads. Despite the challenges, Mexico's southern border remains a trampoline to the U.S. For Here and Now, I'm Lorne Madelon, reporting in Chiapas, Mexico.
A trampoline to the U.S. Lorne's story comes to us from the Fronteras Desk, a public radio collaboration that focuses on the border, immigration, and changing demographics. Tomorrow, how Mexico's southern border crackdown is making migration north more difficult and dangerous. And we want to take a closer look today at the war of words over two words, radical Islam. The New York Times traces it to the Charlie Hebdo attacks in Paris when NPR's Mara Liasson noted that President Obama avoided the phrase. His press secretary said it was because terrorists are trying to cloak themselves in religion. The president calls them thugs. The debate carried on through the presidential campaign with candidates like Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz calling on the president to say radical Islam. Rubio compared not using the phrase to saying, "We weren't at war with Nazis just because some Germans may have been nonviolent Nazis." Well, of course, the difference is we were at war with Nazis. President Obama has said we are not at war with the world's 1.2 billion Muslims. After the Orlando shootings, the president was once again called on to use radical Islam to describe the shooter. Here's part of his response.
What exactly would using this label accomplish?
Well, Donald Trump called that disgraceful.
He's trying to justify why he won't use, and he said radical Islam, because he didn't want to use the word terrorism, if you notice, why he won't use that term or why he doesn't use it. And how it doesn't make any difference, but it does make a difference.
But why do most scholars of Islam reject the phrase? William McCants is a senior fellow in the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, the author of The ISIS Apocalypse, The History, The Strategy, and Doomsday Vision of the Islamic State. Will, your thoughts on the phrase?
Well, academically, it used to be acceptable. One of the best books ever written about the jihadist movement was called Radical Islam by a scholar named Emmanuel Savon. But I think since 9/11, it's become a touchy phrase. President Obama is reflecting the common wisdom in the U.S. government that they don't want to play into the jihadist idea that this is some sort of religious war between the Christian West and the Muslim Middle East.
Yeah, but as you well know, when you said touchy phrase, that's interpreted by many on the right as touchy-feely phrase, what Ted Cruz had called political correctness, this idea of putting sensitivity ahead of security.
Well, from President Obama's perspective, he's putting security against domestic political interests. He wants to make sure to avoid the phrase so he doesn't alienate Muslims around the world who he believes would be offended by it and therefore make them more susceptible to jihadist propaganda.
And why is it offensive? Shadi Hamid, your colleague there at the Brookings Institution, said he used to use the phrase as well. Now it's been so politicized, it's being used as a dog whistle. So let's deconstruct the phrase. Where's the dog whistle in it? We know what radical means, extremist, Islam. What does that word mean?
Well, Islam is a many and varied thing, but when you attach an adjective to it like radical, it's difficult for many non-Muslims to distinguish between the noun and the adjective. And so it seems in the minds of many Muslims that you're telling non-believers that Islam, the entire religion, is a radical thing.
Because that's what Islam means. It means the faith.
That's right.
And you know, this is puzzling to people who may not think of themselves as having any hate agenda. They may understand that there are millions of the 1.2 billion Muslims in the world who are peaceful, but they still don't understand why you can't say radical Islam and mean the extremists that we see in ISIS.
You can certainly say that, and you can mean it. I personally have no problem with the phrase, but I've also traveled enough in the Muslim world to know that the phrase plays very poorly among many normal Muslims. Yeah. And also among Muslim communities in the West, they believe it plays into the idea that the entire religion is radical.
It would be like saying radical Christianity. There may be Christians who hear that as the whole faith is radical.
That's right.
Yeah.
And President Obama is doing his best to avoid this kind of dichotomous thinking that plays into the propaganda of our enemies who want to portray this as a religious war between the Christian West and the Muslim world.
Well, last week when the debate really surged up again after the Orlando shootings and there was a call to use the phrase radical Islam, Hillary Clinton did something she's never done before. She used the phrase radical Islamism. Let's listen.
You know, whether you call it radical jihadism, radical Islamism, I think they mean the same thing. I'm happy to say either. But what I won't do, because I think it is dangerous for our efforts to defeat this threat, is to demonize and demagogue and, you know, declare war on an entire religion. That plays right into ISIS's hands.
But Wilma Kantz, why is radical Islamism different? And others have said, use radical Islamist.
Yeah, it sounds like a distinction without a difference, doesn't it? And mm-hmm. I think for many Muslims, they would still hear the same thing. I mean, Islamism is a modern political movement. But for many normal Muslims, I don't think they're going to hear much of a difference. And this is her trying to take a domestic political issue off the table. So it makes a lot of good sense domestically. But I'm willing to bet that if she were to become commander-in-chief, she would be much more hesitant to use the term radical Islamism.
But we understand that Islamist is different because it implies more of an ideology, like someone who wants a government to be a Muslim-leaning government. That's an ideology as opposed to branding a whole faith.
That is true, and I think you and I understand that. But for normal Muslims around the world, I think it's a distinction that is lost on them.
Scholars of the faith across the board, Stephen Cook at the Council on Foreign Relations, I mentioned Shami Hamid, across the board think that radical Islamist or Islam is dangerous. And phrases like jihadists, Salafis, Islamist extremists are suggested.
Right. And each of those is fraught as well. I mean, you're always going to agitate somebody no matter what phrase you choose. If you want to be academically very precise, you would call this the Salafi jihadist movement. That is what they call themselves. But the term jihadist can offend many Muslims who consider jihad to be a part of their religion and not necessarily violent. I think what President Obama has attempted to do is to avoid the term that will anger the most Muslims.
Yeah. But again, you know, I can hear people who are critics of the president listening to you with your reasoned understanding of what the president is doing and saying, we can't afford to worry about offending someone when we are under attack.
I hear them. Mm-hmm. They should also know that bin Laden, in his own private musings, was upset that the United States did not talk about Islam enough in its propaganda. And he, in fact, wanted to change the name of al-Qaeda to include the name Islam so the United States would have to say it over and over again so Muslims would realize that this is, in fact, a religious struggle against the West. And that's what President Obama is trying to avoid. This is very much part of his thinking about how to make the United States more secure. It is not in an effort to be politically correct with regards to Muslims. If you look at his Jeffrey Goldberg interview, he said many things that would agitate Muslims and the way he characterized the Middle East.
Like what?
Well, he talked about ancient hatreds fueling the conflict in the Middle East. He talked about the Gulf countries not being able to get their act together. But I think this is one area where he has tried to not play into our enemy's propaganda.
Not fall into the trap. Mm-hmm. And you make the case, and just remind people, the Muslim faith is as differentiated as the Christian faith is.
That's right. There's a lot of variety. The kind of Islam that you find in Morocco is entirely different from the kind of Islam that you find in Indonesia. But the president is doing his best to not play into the idea that this is a religious conflict and that the religion at question is a radical one. He wants to point out that it is a many and varied thing. it is interesting. You raise a really good point. Now, this is why I'm not entirely dead set against the critics, because there is a really wishy-washy perspective in the executive branch about the role that religion plays in the conflict that may feed in a little bit to the discussion of terminology.
So how would you suggest, as a scholar, as somebody who's studied this, how do you address that? How do you get across that there is, you know, we know the Wahhabi faith. There are faiths that are feeding into this violence and to this Islamist view of, you know, reestablishing a caliph. How do you address that there is some of that feeding into this without broad brushing the whole faith? What words would you use?
I think you have to do two things. One is to stop making pronouncements about what is and is not Islamic, and the president does that with great frequency, and I don't think it helps. He's not in a position to judge. And the second thing to do is use more precise terminology. Salafi jihadism is what jihadists call their movement. And it is an outgrowth of a very ultra-conservative interpretation of Islam, the kind of Islam that you find in Saudi Arabia that is quite different from other varieties of Islam. And it's often attached to the sort of violence that we're seeing. And I think you're getting much closer to the problem when you use more precise terminology.
Teach people the phrase Salafi jihadism. Perhaps.
The scholar in me would like to think that would work. The policymaker in me thinks, it's a losing cause.
William McCants, senior fellow in the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, author of The ISIS Apocalypse, The History, the Strategy, and Doomsday Vision of the Islamic State. Will, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Remember Diversity Day on NBC's The Office?
You know what? This is a color-free zone here. Stanley, I don't look at you as another race.
See, this is what I'm talking about. We don't have to pretend that we're colorblind.
Exactly.
That's fighting ignorance with more ignorance. No, with more ignorance. Right, exactly.
That's Larry Wilmore playing a diversity consultant who can't get a word in over Steve Carell's Michael Scott. Well, businesses in the U.S. spend hundreds of millions of dollars on diversity training each year, and as that episode suggested, many programs just do not work. And according to research, they may actually make things worse. That's the subject of the cover story in next month's Harvard Business Review, where Kurt Nickisch is senior editor. Hi, Kurt.
Hey, Peter.
So a lot of these diversity programs, they come about because of discrimination lawsuits. But what is the evidence that they're not working?
Yeah, well, I mean, you said it. It's the data. Researchers at Harvard and Tel Aviv University did a really deep dive for this cover story into hundreds of companies. And they found that basically 5 years after a company institutes mandatory diversity training for managers, companies actually saw no improvement. The proportion of white women, black men, and Hispanics in management stayed the same. The share of black women and that of Asian American men and women actually fell.
So they're not working. I guess the feeling is that if you're forced to do something, you might actually buck against it.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I think there's complex psychology going on with these biases, right? And so managers, especially being in the position of being a manager where you have authority and the company says they trust you to help get things done, when they're told you have to go to this training, you have to do things this way, that often ends up backfiring.
Well, there's also this question of hiring tests. This is fascinating. 40% of companies will now give a test to a job applicant so that, in theory at least, everybody's sort of judged on the same playing field. But you're saying even that ends up backfiring.
Yeah, because managers still have a lot of control and they kind of know who they want to hire. And so there's a lot of selective testing that goes on. It's not practiced uniformly. I mean, this has been the case back in the 1950s at like a Chicago meatpacking plant where a black worker took the test. The manager who's hiring said, oh, you failed it, but hired somebody who never even took the test. That kind of stuff still happens today where people, white workers who maybe don't do as well on a test, that gets forgiven. But but a woman or a minority who doesn't do as well on the test, that's viewed more suspiciously.
Oh, okay. But let's get to the good news because there is some. There are actually effective ways to do some of this diversity training so that the organization becomes more diverse. What are they?
Yeah, absolutely. So it turns out that if you don't make it mandatory, if you make voluntary diversity training, you actually give managers more of a say and a role in how it happens. That actually has the desired intended effect. If you assign a woman or a minority to a white male manager, it turns out they get really invested in somebody that they've helped along.
Like a mentorship program.
Yeah, a mentorship program works. And so they end up feeling like that person is deserving. College recruitment programs for women and minorities, those, the data show, they work.
Well, Kurt Nikisch, senior editor at the Harvard Business Review, will link you to this study, this article, at our website, hereandnow.org. Kurt, thank you very much.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Summer is here, and we have a great read for you, perfect for hammocks or when you're out on a dock or a porch swing or wishing you were. Set in Minnesota, it begins as the story of Lars and Cynthia Thorvald. He knows his balding exterior hides the beating heart of a great chef. She's a small-town girl hoping her skills as a budding wine expert will get her out of town. But pretty soon, they are both gone, and we're left with their daughter, Eva, who goes from bullied schoolgirl to 20-something renowned chef, and along the way takes us on a culinary tour of Minnesota, Wisconsin, the Dakotas, from an upscale culinary website to a church basement where women are tasting their dessert bars ahead of a county fair as a violent storm hits.
How exciting, Celeste said, smiling. Well, even if we're stuck here, Sandra said, slicing herself a Mississippi mud pie bar. At least we won't starve to death. Oh my, Karina said, taking a bite. Celeste, these are incredible. Sandra looked at her own tray of bars and shook her head. Well, I don't have a shot this year. Celeste, if we don't finish them all here, I'm going to steal them and take them home. Thank you, Celeste said, looking down at her feet. It's just an old family recipe, nothing special. Why a copper mixing bowl? Pat asked Celeste. Oh, for the egg whites, Celeste said. It stabilizes them. Don't ask me how. Barb looked at Pat. You didn't know that? I actually don't separate my eggs for bars. When I'm making a souffle or sponge cake, I add a little cream of tartar to my egg whites, and that does the trick for me. The other women nodded. Oh, don't get me wrong, though. Who wouldn't love to have a copper mixing bowl? Pat was quick to add. But we just gotta work with what God gives us.
And that is fierce competition, Minnesota style. The book also includes a recipe for those terrific Mississippi mud pie bars and Eva's upscale meals. The book is called Kitchens of the Great Midwest. It's out in paperback. We spoke with author J. Ryan Straddle last August and started by asking, where did this come from?
I grew up in Minnesota. I grew up in a small town called Hastings. And I grew up in a house that wasn't always challenging culinary-wise, but a very warm, loving house. And I had always wanted to travel the world, and I couldn't afford it. I only had my mom's Volkswagen Golf and my earnings from the Sam Goody store at the mall. So my high school girlfriend and I would go to the unusual and ethnic restaurants in Minneapolis and St. Paul in high school, and that's when I first developed an interest in food was as a stand-in for travel.
Isn't that something? Because I was thinking that the book is about food and the appeal of food, but it's also a little bit about a class divide. Eva ends up growing up in the home of her aunt and uncle. She declares of them that their tastes are so plebeian, frozen peas and fish sticks and things like that. Is that something that came from your own experience?
I think so. And what's impressive to me is that my dad's taste has evolved commensurate with the rest of the country's. In the last 20 years, as we've seen a new realm of food consciousness, my dad is probably now one of the healthiest eaters I know, and he eats he's as much of a locavore and a farm-to-table guy as anyone I know.
Well, that's what this book does. It sort of tracks that evolution of America's palates through Eva, this precocious mm-hmm. young woman who seemed – she and her dad were both sort of at the head of this curve. Is she maybe someone you would have wanted to be, growing habanero peppers in her closet?
I did my own version of that growing up. Yeah, I was a little kid with really encompassing obsessions. Like a lot of little kids, I started with dinosaurs, but then I went into U.S. presidents, and I just got to know everything about the U.S. presidents. And then I got into baseball, and Eva does the same thing. I feel like Eva was a lot more focused than I was. She figured out early on what she was good at and what she enjoyed doing and just pursued it. I wish I was like her.
Well, but she was something of an outcast, you know.
Yeah. She had a tough time, particularly in middle school, as did I. I was bullied in middle school in much the same way she was. And the sort of friendships that I made at that time, the people who said, it gets better, made a huge impression on me. And I wanted to help tell that story as well.
Well, and food is the thing that helps her survive the bullying as
yes.
a child. But how much of this did you have to research? For instance, she grows these chocolate habanero peppers, and one batch is 500,000 Scoville heat units. Mm. Her father, Lars, is obsessed. He can't buy a tomato unless he knows whether it's a moon glow with the highest amount of lycopene or a San Marzano, which might be better for paste and sauce. Do you also know these things, or is this what you had to research?
In my life, I'm lucky to know a couple of professional chefs and a few heirloom tomato enthusiasts and a dad who grows hot peppers in his garden, and I just plumb to their knowledge. And I did do a lot of original research. And let me tell you, going back to the Midwest and eating for research, it was pretty fun.
Well, why? What were some of the things that you ate?
Lutefisk. I hadn't had that since I was a kid. I'm not sure if I'll have it again.
Remind people what this gelatinous thing is.
It's a reconstituted whitefish that is the specialty of Scandinavian kitchens during Advent. I went and bought it a few years ago while researching it for this book, and it still tastes like boiled aquarium water. however, you know, the Swedes and the Norwegians who make it in Minnesota tend to douse it in cream sauce, and that sure helps.
Well, but there, you know, there's an interesting setup here. The food starts to represent the class divide, maybe, or the generational divide that we were talking about, the cultural divide. There's a lutefisk, but then there's also walleye, freshwater fish. Eva dines on one in River Falls, Wisconsin, that is to die for. There's also dinner parties with menus like open-faced Kobe beef sliders and summer heirloom tomato casserole. There's the dinners that Eva famously begins to make, but then there's also Pat, who makes her dessert bars and is very confused about the change that's happening with food in the area. Tell us more about why you bring Pat into this. You've got Eva soaring as a contemporary chef, but Pat seems so confused about the changes in food.
Oh, that's such a great question. I was born in Pat's world. That's the Minnesota I grew up in, was the world of Lutheran church basement dinners and bars and ambrosia salad, jello salad. And I think that's just great. I love that, Minnesota. And I hope the evolving food consciousness in the country and in the upper Midwest doesn't completely erase it. And that chapter, to me, felt like a love letter to that culinary realm of Minnesota. I felt like, oh, man, this is a thriving realm, and it's recipes that, you know, sustained generations through Minnesota. The bar recipes in that chapter are from my great-grandmother's cookbook.
You, in fact, give thanks to your great-grandmother Lois Bly Johnson and her church, the First Lutheran Church of Hunter, North Dakota, and all the contributors to the 1984 edition of the First Lutheran Church Women Cookbook.
Yes. I mostly use the 84 edition. I also have the 1969 edition, but the recipes in that book say things like, cook until done, because they were, quite frankly, written by women that knew how to do it. And so I really enjoyed that realm of American and Midwestern cooking, and I really wanted to honor it. But at the same time, I wanted to recognize, as you put it, the contrast between where that cooking fits in within the current realm of, oh, I guess you could say Epicurean appreciation of food now that's been evolving over the last 20 years or so, that's commensurate with Eva's maturation and rise. I'd like to live in a world where they both exist.
Yeah.
And I think in places like Minnesota, they do, and harmoniously. One of the things I wanted Eva to do was reconcile those two worlds. I also wanted to work in the story of a guy like Jordy Snelling, who, as a deer hunter, he has a more intimate and intense relationship with food than an awful lot of people.
Well, you have Eva bring them all together in the end. We will not give anything away. But it occurs that, boy, Garrison Keillor has nothing on you. I mean, it has that same kind of feel of Prairie Home Companion, only with great recipes. And also with a slightly darker, I mean, you're not afraid of darker off-roads for many of these characters.
Yeah, I decided to make life pretty difficult for some of my characters. And that was hard for me. I love these people. I loved waking up every morning and being in their world and writing them and seeing what they would do. To see them suffer was really, really hard for me. But I felt like, oh, man, they need to grow. They need to evolve. I want to see what they do in the face of challenges. But the best year of my life was spent writing this book and being with these people. And when I finally finished working with the editor, I was so sad to not get to work with these people anymore, to not wake up and be in this world.
Well, J. Ryan Straddle, we have to say that every day reading it was pretty good, too.
Oh, thanks.
We smell sequel at the end, we're just saying. Oh. So the book that we're talking about is Kitchens of the Great Midwest, author J. Ryan Straddle. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome, Robin.
Firefighters in California are struggling to put out several wildfires, two in the suburbs of Los Angeles, another not far from Santa Barbara. California's drought has left huge swaths of the state dangerously dry. But of course, the U.S. is not alone dealing with the problem. The World Resources Institute has mapped chronic droughts around the world. Betsy Otto is director of the Institute's water program. And Betsy, we hear about drought a lot lately. Is climate change making it worse?
You know, I don't think we can say that we know that to be the case yet. I mean, if you look at even just in the U.S., in the 100-year history, 100-year record going back from today, there were three or four major drought events, you know, those that we've heard about before, the 1930s Dust Bowl. There was a very serious drought in the 1950s. In a 25-year period from 1980 to 2005, there were actually nine drought events that were pretty severe in the U.S. that exceeded $1 billion in damage at each time of those events. Mm. Are they getting worse because of climate change? It's not clear yet. What we do seem to be seeing is more frequent droughts and more intense droughts in many parts of the world. And the projections in the future is that may increase. So that may be the new normal.
Well, where is it worse? I'm looking at headlines, and India comes to mind. It's had its worst drought in a century before some monsoon rains did eventually provide some relief. But it's been so bad that farmers have been committing suicide. And earlier this month, I was reading that the city of Mumbai had just 25 days of water left in its reservoirs. So what's the future look like for India?
The situation is really serious right now in India. It's one of the most populous countries in the world, of course. It's generally arid in many parts of the country. Some parts are quite wet, very similar to the U.S. But when you have a really extreme drought situation as we have now, they've been experiencing below average monsoons now for a number of years, more and more people are being affected. And because so much of the population in India lives in rural areas and depends on farming for their livelihood to survive, it's really very dire.
I'm also looking at the Middle East. As we know, Syria is at war, but it's also in drought. Yemen is among the most water insecure countries in the world.
Yes, it's true. Of course, the Middle East countries and North African countries are naturally arid, but they have in many instances, you know, booming populations, especially in cities. And so their water demand situation is quite high relative to, you know, very limited water resources. Syria is an interesting case. There's been a lot of research that was done on a very severe drought that lasted 4 or 5 years, which forced farmers and herders off of their sort of ancestral lands. They moved to cities, created more pressure in those cities on available jobs. It certainly wasn't the cause of the conflict in Syria, but it might have exacerbated that situation. And what we'd hate to see happen in other countries is for, you know, similar pressures to be brought to bear because of water resource management.
Just in the past few days, we've seen record-breaking heat in the Southwest. And Lake Mead this year is at its lowest level in its history. So what are you watching closer to home in this country?
Well, that's a really alarming situation around Lake Mead. We know that the Colorado River, some of the agreements that were reached amongst the states and between the U.S. and Mexico decades and decades ago were made during a particularly wet period in the river's history. And so, you know, we may have established a management regime that's honestly not going to match the new normal under a drier, more climate change affected world.
Well, we've heard a lot this year about El Nino. How's that affected things?
Well, we're seeing one of the worst El Ninos in decades. So the result of that in many parts of the world is very severe drought, ongoing drought over multiple years. So it's having a really significant impact. Of course, in some places it means floods
more
water. Exactly. But what it's definitely having the effect, for example, in Africa, you know, the UN estimates are 40 to 50 million people right now across 13 countries in Africa are at very serious risk of malnutrition, really in a food crisis. So That's the kind of impact that an El Nino event this severe can have.
We've laid out a lot of different places across the globe that are struggling. Do you think that each solution in each place is different, or is there, generally speaking, something that can be done to help solve this problem?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, the solutions are context-specific, no question about it. Having said that, there are things that every place should be doing. And the first is to really use the best available data to look at long-term trends, both historical and projecting future into the future. World Resources Institute has created an open-source tool called Aqueduct and our Water Risk Atlas that helps all users understand where those risks may be occurring today and some plausible projections into the future. Are we pricing water at its real value? Are there things that could be done through changes in prices or other kinds of incentives, make it actually capture its true cost? When we run out of water, which is happening in certain places, the cost becomes extreme. There are some technological innovations that could occur as well. So there are many kinds of management strategies that could be put in place anywhere in the world that will really help us manage water more effectively.
Betsy Otto is director of the Global Water Program for the World Resources Institute. Betsy, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we'll link you to the group's interactive drought map at hereandnow.org. It's fascinating and beautiful at the same time. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.